That's why people are scared about us doing this. So we're going to put our hand in the cookie jar and we're never going to pull it out.
The bill to overhaul the permanent fund dies in a House committee. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 17th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the cooperative international work of the Coast Guard goes on regardless of political tensions.
When it comes to saving lives and protecting the environment, those are kind of universally accepted goods that both countries realize should be beyond any geopolitical interest.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. Mount Edgecombe High School provides a curriculum rich in culture and diversity, offering over 80 courses, from art to advanced engineering, and with activities from native dance to kayaking. Class sizes are no larger than 30. Explore your talents and develop your dreams. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
A bill to restructure permanent fund earnings and cut fund dividends died in the House Finance Committee today. The bill is the cornerstone of Governor Bill Walker's plan to bring stability to state government finances. But six of the 11 committee members voted against sending the bill to a vote by the full House. The bill stumbled over concerns that voters wouldn't accept cuts if the legislature didn't make other changes. Republican members want to further reduce the size of government, while Democrats want to further cut tax credits to the oil and gas industry. Anchorage Republican Lance Pruitt voted against the bill. He says he doesn't want to spend fund earnings without ensuring they won't fuel more government.
That's why people are scared about us doing this. So we're going to put our hand in the cookie jar and we're never going to pull it out.
Dillingham Majority Caucus Democrat Bryce Edgman says the state has no other options for closing the $3 to $4 billion annual deficit. He urged Walker to make another attempt to build public support. Without a PFD reduction, Edgman is concerned the state will spend all fund earnings and eliminate dividends.
In my district, you know, I've got a lot of people who support this. I got a lot of people support income taxes. But as I look around the table here, and I talked to a lot of my colleagues, there's other parts of the state where that support doesn't exist.
Committee co-chair Fairbanks Republican Steve Thompson voted to advance the bill, arguing that Walker will soon call the legislature back into another special session. The current special session will end on Tuesday, but it's not clear whether any votes will change in another session closer to the August primary, in which votes to cut PFDs could be used against lawmakers. Activity in the Arctic is on the rise. Retreating sea ice and rising ship traffic have some worried the region could serve as the next stage for international conflict. But as KNOM's Emily Russell reports, Coast Guards across the Arctic are busy laying the groundwork for cooperation.
Russia just launched the largest, most powerful icebreaker in the world. A YouTube video shows blue and red balloons flying through the air as onlookers cheer from the docks of St. Petersburg Shipyard. It's a massive vessel, bright blue with the Russian flag painted front and center on the bow of the boat. The icebreaker is the first in a series of ships the nation plans to launch in the coming years. And that worries many, since Russia's icebreaker fleet is larger than every other Arctic nation combined. But Andreas Ostagen says that isn't foreshadowing an Arctic-style arms race.
I don't think it's all about counting icebreakers, as some tend to do in the Arctic.
He says what's more important is how the captains of those icebreakers cooperate. Ostagen works for the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies in Oslo. In an article recently published in the Arctic Review on Law and Politics, Ostagen argues coast guards are the key to keeping the peace in the far north.
All the Arctic coast guards have different institutional setups. They have different capabilities. They have different or lack of capabilities. So I think sharing information and also sharing best practices is key.
And they've been doing just that through the Arctic Coast Guard Forum established last fall. Leaders representing the coast guards of all eight Arctic nations gathered again in Boston recently to sign a multi-year strategic plan for the Arctic. The joint agreement joins an increasingly lengthy list of international accords for the region. There's the Arctic Search and Rescue Agreement, adopted in 2011, and the Agreement on Cooperation on Marine Oil Pollution, Preparedness, and Response in the Arctic, adopted in 2013. Ultimately, Ustagin says the severe weather and remoteness of the region necessitates cooperation between coast guards.
If an incident were to occur, let's say an oil spill actually took place in the Arctic, or a cruise ship were to go down in the Northwest Passage or around Greenland or in the Bering Sea or Barents Sea, then everyone would have the interest of trying to save these people, trying to minimize damage.
An incident did occur in 2014 when a Korean fishing vessel went down in the Bering Sea. At the Glacier Conference in Anchorage last fall, Rear Admiral Dan Abel said the Coast Guard was in constant communication with Russian search and rescue efforts.
We were posting messages, we were synchronizing their response, we were synchronizing what South Korea was sending, and at the tactical level, things were working extremely well.
While nearly everyone aboard the vessel died at sea, Abel said both the U.S. and Russia shared the same objective.
When it comes to saving lives and protecting the environment, those are kind of universally accepted goods that both countries realize that should be beyond any geopolitical interest.
Those geopolitical interests have come to a head at recent years with Russia's annexation of Crimea and resulting international sanctions. Because of that and lingering Cold War tensions with the U.S., Abel says he's not completely carefree when he sends the Healy, one of only two American icebreakers, into the Arctic.
There is no buddy system for her. If she dings a prop, she has some problem with the reduction gear, there's nothing with an American flag that's going to come save her. So as far as things that keep me up at night, that's one of those. If you extend that far into some very hostile area, she's a lone vessel out there. And we certainly wish her a safe voyage, get her work done, and get her home.
The Healy just set sail for its first solo trip in the Arctic this season. It's not as strong or shiny as Russia's newest icebreaker, but with less emphasis on military operations and more on research, for now it doesn't have to be. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
The state has begun issuing licenses to marijuana growers, processors, and sellers. That has entrepreneurs gearing up for operations, hoping to get into a fledgling enterprise. One Fairbanks area farm has been cleared to start pot cultivation. But as KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the operation is seeing large capital outlays to accommodate state regulations.
Mike Emmers knows how to successfully raise and sell crops. His Rosie Creek farm has been in operation for almost 20 years. Gazing across his fields, you might be looking on any small farm with a weathered tractor standing beside rows of planted crops. But getting to his farm is just a little harder these days. That's a security fence Emmers has installed.
On top of that security fence is actually a security system, which is probably the most expensive piece of the puzzle, and that the state requires live video feed, video recording for 40 days, facial recognition in the marijuana crop at 20 feet.
Emmers says there are so many security requirements, he's had to turn to an outside security agency to accommodate them all. Not that he's complaining. He says the state has thought through the process of growing and selling marijuana. But like any business, he'll be passing on the cost when pricing his certified organic product.
We have a ballpark figures from other states and what the going price per pound or per ounce or per gram of marijuana is. And just like any other business commodity, we'll see what the cost of production are and we'll price our product accordingly.
Additional requirements mean his kids can no longer access the family farm. Emmers says he wouldn't be going through all the hassles of entering the marijuana market if age and thin profit margins weren't forcing his hand.
The alternative is quitting farming because it's getting too hard to make minimal profits with vegetables as I'm getting older.
Despite that, Emmers will also tell you he's excited about entering a frontier industry. For now, though, he's racing to get a crop into the ground and see what the first harvest will bring. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, learning to ski jump in the summer.
And you crash for that whole day, and then next thing you know, you don't crash. I didn't crash today.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
A raft carrying at least 10 people capsized during a guided trip on Alaska's North Slope, leaving two Nevada women dead. The North Slope Borough says in a statement the victims were 69-year-old Cheryl Minahan and 67-year-old Karen Todd. Hometowns and more information, including whether this was a tourist outing, were not immediately available. The borough's Department of Search and Rescue received a report Wednesday of two people missing after a boat capsized on the Kunakuk River, about 75 miles south of Koktovik. Koktovik is a small community on the Beaufort Sea off Alaska's northern coast, about 625 miles north of Anchorage. The borough and the Alaska Air National Guard safely recovered eight other people and took them to the community of Dead Horse. The guard found the bodies of the missing rafters yesterday. The North Slope Borough Police Department is investigating the deaths. A couple in Napakiak has found the body of George Mute, age 26, of Kungiganak. Mute went missing in September. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Mike Riley, Bethel Search and Rescue President, says the couple was on the Kuskokwim River near Napakiak last Friday looking for wood when they saw something floating in the water.
It looked like a bag, and then they went to check, and that's what they seen is the remains.
Bethel Search and Rescue, along with Alaska State Troopers, retrieved the body and transported it to the State Medical Examiner's Office in Anchorage, who identified the remains as George Mute.
It was kind of hard to make identification with visual, so that's why he had to get shipped into Anchorage and do a identification through dental records.
Alaska State Troopers report Mute went missing in September after a boat carrying him and two other men collided with a sandbar on the Kuskokwim River near Nabuskiak, stranding the boat. Bethel Search and Rescue found the two other men and began an over 2-month search for Mute. At its peak, the search involved over 50 searchers, 30 boats, and multiple aerial surveys. After a few weeks, the search changed to a recovery effort looking for Mute's body. Riley says Bethel Search and Rescue suspended the search during freeze-up and resumed searching this spring. Mute's family held a memorial for Mute in Kungiganak in December. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
For decades, many of the processors in Bristol Bay have been large companies with offices in Washington and parent companies in foreign countries. But two small communities are developing locally owned processing plants. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
Bristol Bay's fishing communities have long been dependent on the companies that turn raw fish into a marketable product and get it shipped out of the bay. The communities of Port Hyden and Leavelock now want to take on that role themselves and hopefully keep more of the decisions and the benefits local. Native Village of Port Hyden Business Development Director Adrienne Christensen says the Meshek Processing Center there should be up and running this summer.
We wanted to start a local tribally owned fish processing plant so that we could create a longer season for our fishermen, also to have our fishermen fish close to home so that they don't have to go all the way up to Ugashik to fish, and to provide them with a higher price for their fish because we'll be doing direct marketing and have a higher quality product that will mean more jobs and more pay for the fishermen.
Right now, the village is waiting on some freezer equipment ordered from Anchorage. Once it arrives and the fish are hitting, they'll buy up to 10,000 pounds per day. Hopefully, she says, from local fishermen. There's about half a dozen Bristol Bay fishery permit holders living in Port Hyden. Their fish will get sold around the state.
We're focusing on Alaska markets first. So selling to the school district, selling to Anchorage markets, and selling to local stores first.
Once things really get going, Christensen says the Meshic Processing Center wants to buy during a longer season than typical processors, starting with Kings and staying open through Silvers. They also want to expand and purchase a Japanese freezer system.
We are working on getting that technology, but because it's very expensive, we are getting the funding together to be able to purchase it. The one small freezer system that we want to purchase is over $1 million.
Meanwhile, leave lock packing is probably a year out. Village Council President Alexander Talik-Balak says they're waiting on final approval for a $2 million infrastructure grant from the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. In the meantime, they've been building the plant piece by piece using community block grants for the past 5 years.
Right now, we have about $1.8 million into the project. Every year, we purchase materials and equipment and build a processing plant with local hire. And all the projects were small projects, but at the end of the day, we're going to have a fully equipped processing plant.
Last winter, the community went to the State Board of Fisheries and asked for more commercial fishing opportunity on the Alagnac River. After BBEDC agreed to help fund it, the board agreed to create a new management plan there, about 8 miles from the village. Leavelock Packing hopes to buy fish from the 5 local permit holders in Leavelock, as well as others from the region who want to fish the new area, including set netters from Dillingham, Iliamna Lake area, and Naknek Quijack. They also think they'll do so during a longer season.
We would be open to shoulder seasons in the beginning and toward the end, which means, you know, we plan to fish before the regular commercial sockeye season, and then we plan to do some fall fishing after the commercial sockeye season. We'd like to do silvers and chums, and that'll keep our fish plant open longer.
Despite the plans for a building and a fishery, Leavelock doesn't know exactly where it'll sell the fish. Talik-Palik says a roundtable is planned this fall to work on marketing plans and also figure out what sort of product the plant will sell, whether frozen fillets or something else. For both communities, the plants are part of a larger effort to develop more robust local economies.
Right now, our community is about 70-some people. The majority of us adults here, we all have jobs with the fish plant, with our barge, and with the high tunnel, and some of the small grant projects that we've got here. So, you know, we're all getting a lot of work and a lot of excitement with the fish processing plant.
The Leavelock plant has been in the works for more than 2 decades, and only time will tell if 2017 will finally be its year. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, summer skiing. Last week, the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage was able to practice on some brand new jumps at the Hilltop Ski Area. This is the first summer ski jump facility in the state. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early dropped by to see some young athletes in action.
The Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage is a group that helps kids learn and compete in various winter sports, among them, ski jumping. For many young Alaskan jumpers, the only time they have to practice is when there's actual snow to ski on.
Some families have been able to come up with the money to send their kids outside and summer jump,
in the lower 48. We feel strongly that all of our kids should have the opportunity and shouldn't be limited.
That's Karen Compton, the program director for NSAA. Compton, along with a batch of volunteers, have worked over the last 2 years to bring a summertime outdoor ski jump to Anchorage, the first of its kind in Alaska. Built on an older, broken-down jump, the new ski jump is a huge, expensive project. The facility is built using a combination of steel tracks, water, and a special plastic grass surface to simulate slippery snow and allow for year-round ski jumping. Kids align their skis with metal tracks and then slide down the plastic grassy jump, flying through the air. Someone is normally standing by, monitoring the wetness level of the grass with a hose. Wetter grass means faster speeds, and some of the beginners are not quite ready for that pace yet.
Go to the rail, get in your end run position, put your hands out here.
That's Zach Hamill, the ski jump coach for the older kids, but he notes that the age range of their skiers is highly varied.
I believe our youngest is 4, and then we have adult jumping, so I think our oldest is 66 years old. So if you're a little toddler and you can walk and you can ski, then you can ski jump. And if you can still walk in your older ages, you can ski jump as well.
Hamill says that skiing on the plastic grass jumps is not very different from skiing on snow.
It's actually more consistent, which is nice. Living up here in Alaska, or even a winter climate anywhere, basically you get a lot of inconsistent skiing conditions. But with summer, it's always the same.
Hamill says, in recent years, it's been challenging to get kids well prepared for competitions. Between lack of summer practice equipment and weak winter conditions in Anchorage, the kids only get major practice right before out-of-state competitions.
Last winter was extremely brutal. We went down to Junior Nationals in Salisbury, Connecticut, and none of my elite skiers had even skied that size hill all winter. We got like 2 days of jumping in, and then the next day was the competition, and it was just kind of like, all right, guys, I know you haven't trained and we're not really prepared, but just go out there and do your best. Still, I mean, without the training, you just can't be that competitive.
Ready, Annika?
Natasha Mattoon, the other ski coach, is originally from Wisconsin, where outdoor ski jumps are easily accessible. She says the new facility will drastically improve results.
It's going to be great. Like in the Midwest where I'm from, they have summer training, and you can really see like how quickly the kids develop just because they can jump all year round. So now that we have the summer program and we can jump winter and summer, these kids will improve at a much quicker rate.
You're on time that time. Let's do that again.
But what do the kids think of their new jumps? Well, Carter Burbaker is 10 years old, and he's been skiing for about 3 years now.
I think having summer jumps here in Alaska helps a lot because we get more training in, and we can get better, and we can excel faster, and so fly farther and have better places in the competitions.
Even the youngest jumpers, like 6-year-old Riley Cooper, are showing more confidence.
The scariest part about ski jumping is when you first start jump skis, because jump skis, the heels flip up, and you start crossing. And you cross, like, for that whole day. And then next thing you know, you don't cross. I didn't cross today.
Compton says, with the newer facility, a dream like becoming an Olympic-level skier is a closer reality for the kids to grasp.
You know, within probably 10 years, we'll have Olympians because we have strong skiers. Now we have added the ski jumping piece, and the ability to train intensely in both of those sports will produce national team members and Olympians. It just will.
Even if the kids aren't necessarily here to become Olympians, there are other benefits. Burbaker says, while he enjoys doing other types of sports, ski jumping gives him a feeling unlike any other.
There's no sports where you really get to go and fly. And here at ski jumping, you get to like fly, and it's really fun. I really like flying.
With help from Ammon Swenson, I'm Wesley Early in Anchorage.
Woo!
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Perevdilim Inkbut. She recently graduated from Unalaska High School, where she was valedictorian.
I came from Mongolia about 3 years ago as a sophomore here. I was thinking that it would be probably colder. And when I think of Alaska, I just think of like dog mushing and ice. But when I get here in Unalaska, it was like so different. Like there was no caribou or like bears. Just for homeworks, I had to sit for like 5 to 6 hours at least. to like translate all my textbooks and homeworks and try to understand my lectures from all my teachers and everything. I actually learned English since I was in fourth grade, I believe, but then it was not good at all. I was not fluent. I could not like understand what people were saying. I could not read a lot of book except like third or fourth grade books. When I was in Mongolia, I was not a reader at all. I did not read books for fun. My stepmother took me to the public library and handed me some books to try, and when I opened the books, I just could not understand any of that, and it was just not fun for me to try to read all of them. But then one book caught my eye, and it was The Lightning Thief by Rick Riordan. When I opened the first page of the book, it warned me to stop reading if I thought I was a half-blood, and I didn't know what half-blood meant. So I was like, if you're gonna warn me to stop reading, I'm just gonna keep reading. I'm actually going back to my home country, Mongolia, and I'm gonna be there for the whole summer, and I'm gonna come back in August and go to college at UAA. I honestly feel like I'll miss Alaska when I go to Mongolia, which is kind of ironic because I probably wouldn't have never thought I would miss some other country other than my home country.
Parevdalam Inkbut lives in Unalaska. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Wesley Early and Zoe Sobel. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Russell in Nome, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Molly Dishner in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.